Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
The only real advantage to being in here right now is that it's much cooler than it is outside. So I think pretty soon we'll heat it up with a bit of our conversation, which I think we're all looking forward to. Nice to see everyone. Glad we've got a full group to kind of hear some of the work that's underway. I'm Jonathan Pershing. I'm the Dean of the Global School of Sustainability here at the London School of Economics. And I'd like to welcome you all to this evening's conversation, which is on global trends in climate mitigation. I think many of you came because you know exactly what you're going to hear, which is really interesting material with a lot of new insight and an update on a global phenomenon, which we can kind of record and think about how things are transpiring in this agenda. We've got a few just announcements before I start off. We've got some things that we always have to do here. This event is being recorded and live streamed. That, among other things, means please turn your cell phones to silent because they can interfere with the process. And when we have Q&A, we'll actually invite questions from our live stream audience, and that'll be a chance for us to get feedback from others who couldn't make it to the room. Just for people who are aware, it's hot, not quite so hot in here, but if you need some, there's water right outside. They'll be replenished, so if that turns out to be an issue, there are also stewards. So if you're feeling that the heat is a bit much, please contact one of them and they'll make sure that they can take care of you. There's going to be a drinks reception outside after this event, so hopefully people will stay around. Among other things, that'll be just right outside. So among other things, if people have a chance to continue the conversation, that's an opportunity to do so both with our panel and with each other. I think all of you have a variety of things that you're working on that are connected to this discussion. This event is being co-hosted by the Grantham Research Institute and my Global School of Sustainability, which is all part of London Climate Action Week. So really delightful to have everyone here today to hear a bit about what's underway and where we're going. This is an annual series. So this report is not a first-time initiative, although I think there's a lot of new insight and information in it. It's not the first time. Trying to maintain an ongoing longitudinal record of the kinds of things that are happening out here. It's part of a broader commitment to producing policy-relevant research. I think our thinking broadly, not just in this report, but in everything we do, is that the policy outcomes really matter. The idea of producing information is to have it used, not just to understand it, but for the betterment of society, which is actually the motto of the university. So we have a real desire to be constructive and supportive. The key themes that will be covered in this report come from really a history and evolution of the system. If we look back a number of years ago, there were just a handful of cases, now there are hundreds. And how do we think about that growth and where is that taking us? We'll hear a bit about that from the panel. There's also a set of trends on how legal responsibility is unfolding, what governments and corporations are doing in addressing some of the legal liabilities and in the case law that's being developed through those. There's a whole set of questions around litigation itself. How do we think of litigation and its role at this particular moment in climate change and climate change policy? They're clearly affecting outcomes. Some cases we may hear about as recent as today that could be significant ones that are coming along in our conversation. We have really an extraordinary panel to share some of that with us this evening. Maria Antonia Tigre, who is the Director of Global Climate Change Litigation at the Sabin Center on Climate Change and Law at Columbia University, is with us online. Good to see you. Thank you for making it. She's going to focus a bit of her remarks on remedies that the cases seek and that they achieve. She'll be followed by Ruchi Parekh, who's a barrister at Cornerstone Chambers, who's acted in several of the cases discussed in this report. And she's going to give an overview of the landscape here in the UK. Michael Lerner is an assistant professor of political science and public policy in the Department of Government here at LSE. Michael will speak a bit about the role of litigation in shaping the political economy dynamics of the transition. So we're going to start off first, though, with a broad introduction of the report and its findings. And I'd like to turn the floor over in just 1 second to Joanna and Kate, who will talk about it. And the 1 second is to say that I actually have a real personal interest in this. It turns out that my daughter was at the International Court of Human Rights and has been part of some of the cases looking at this discussion, so I feel a personal connection to some of the work that's being discussed here. So it's an honor and a pleasure to have a great panel, and I look forward to the discussion. Joanna or Kate?
Hello, good evening. Is this microphone good all the way to the back? Great. Very good. So thank you very much, Jonathan. Thank you very much, all of you here today and online. On the thank you moment, I also feel I have a few extra thank yous to say. So first of all, a big thanks to the Sabin Center at Columbia University, who spends the whole year collecting the data that then we analyze. Also many other data providers around the world that do this out of love. Big thanks to the team at LSE, the research assistants, the editors, the events people, everyone here who helps this event and the report happening. Big thanks to the reviewers. This is a report that is more reviewed than any academic publication that I've ever published. It's incredible. They destroy us 10 times and we rewrite it 20 times. Many of you are here, so thank you for that. And I think that's it for now in terms of thank you. Now, let's start with the presentation of this year's report. So what do we do? Why do we do? Every year, as you know, we publish this report. This is the 9th edition of the Global Trends in Climate Litigation. And why do we put ourselves through this? Because, first of all, because law is an important pillar of our society, because law reflects our values, what is already there, but also law has been a catalyst of change in a matter that is hugely important. And we have set ourselves this challenge of following every single case that is filed, that is decided, that someone told us about, and we try to make sense of that. We try to see how they connect with each other, because they don't naturally do that. And we try to tell that story, to zoom out and to come up with a big picture that is then presented in this report. This year, because it just grows so much, we have actually 3 different forms of this report that you will find. One is a summary of the report with the key numbers, the highlights, the figures, and implications for different groups, policymakers, legislators, etc. The second one is a very long report that is almost like the storytelling, the narrative of this year's. And of course, it's not just this year's, it's the build up to this. And then finally, we are gonna record an audible version, because if you want to get through the whole report without reading it, we thought maybe while you're doing the dishes, you might want to listen to Kate and I narrate the report. So it's gonna be in those 3 forms, and we welcome all the feedback. Good, so let me now actually begin. We usually start with this graph that has the numbers. And what we usually see is that gradually there is this growth in number of cases. Now we have 3,600 cases around 62 countries that we have identified. You will also notice this year that there is a spike in 2024. When we presented this report last year, that spike wasn't there because the cases entered the database more recently, and the bulk of this spike is around 200 cases filed by public prosecutors in Brazil. And this tells us something also about what we're observing in terms of new actors entering the field. Public prosecutors had started and now clearly have understood more about what these cases can be. These are cases that are looking into illegal deforestation and translating that into what are the damages, quantifiable damages to the climate system. Also, these cases tell us something about litigation getting into a phase of enforcement, which is part of the story that we're going to tell you, and I'll tell you more soon. Despite this large number of cases in Brazil, the majority is still a Global South located, so we have 81% in the Global North, And overall, the ranking is that explains that is the US has over 2,000 cases, and then followed by Brazil, Australia, UK, Germany. And this gives you a bit of a sense of what is happening around the world. So this year, we go about a bit differently in the report, as I said. And instead of, like previous years, where we would classify all those cases according to the strategy, what the cases were trying to get, the theory of change behind that we tried to guess, this year, we have organized the story into these five themes. So it started very much last year. This wasn't in the report, but as I was preparing the presentation here at the launch, this started becoming a bit of a feeling that, yeah, I can see this. And I checked with Kate. She was on maternity leave, and she said, let's go with that for next one. So Kate came back, and we retold the story around these five themes. So what is the story? First, what we're seeing is a story of maturity. And this maturity is going to be observed, and I will tell you this part, as climate litigation being a recognized dimension of global climate governance. Second, a story of expansion and innovation. And this is seen across new locations, new actors, new legal theories. Third, there is also a story of backlash that existed already, but now is seen in a different scale with a different type of coordination, with pushback underway against both climate action and climate litigation. Fourth, a story of complexity. And this growing complexity is seen in the main trade-offs in the politics involved in the policy responses. And then finally, something very important, which is the so what of this, which is not only the impacts, but how this is being implemented. So we'll go very quickly through all of these. Bear with us, and then you can see much more in the written report. So beginning with maturity, we have seen in the last 2 years, as you probably all know, advisory opinions that were issued by international courts. We have the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea, we have the International Court of Human Rights, and we have the International Court of Justice. What happened this last year, and we discuss in the report, is that these the core and references to these three advisory opinions have trickled down into litigation in domestic courts, both in terms of the filings, but also judges in their decisions engaging with these. At the same time, we continue seeing cases progressing in domestic courts. Last year, we did this first count of how many courts had reached apex courts. We have continued to count and analyze this further, and we see that there are 215 cases that have been decided by apex courts, therefore no more appeals there, final decisions. And interestingly, more than half of these cases have resulted in outcomes that are positive for climate action. So we asked Gabby to illustrate this cycle that we could see, this ecosystem where one decision feeds the next case and the next case feeds into this, you know, tree that you can see here beautifully in the slide, but also outside and in the report. So I guess this illustrates well how we're seeing this ecosystem of reinforcing, reiterating, slowly building. A tree takes time to grow. This ecosystem is taking some time, but it is growing. It is feeding new species, birds and insects. So the last part of the maturity story that I wanted to bring is, I should have mentioned in the previous slide, what is important there is that I was talking about litigation against governments, and the headline there is that really there is addressing climate change for governments is no longer a political choice, it is really a duty. And so that is very crystallized all the way from the international to the domestic courts, and then we see a different type of maturing situation in litigation against corporations. So here, the maturity that we observe, and it's fine that the different levels of maturity, and we observe maturity in that so many cases now have crossed a critical threshold, whereas cases had stopped on the door of the courtrooms and were not admissible because it was not clear to the judges why those people were bringing the case or why they were bringing the case against this company or whether that court was the right court to decide on that matters. What we started observing, and we have done now a closer analysis, is that that number has increased. We have looked into both the backward cases, the polluters pays that are seeking that compensation, and the forward-looking cases that are trying to get companies to align with the Paris Agreement and with the climate science in general, that out of the 30 cases of that those types, 15 have passed that threshold, that admissibility threshold. Also interesting, we do an analysis of how one feeds into the other, and what we see is that in 70% of corporate framework cases, there is reference to a decision or a case in brought against governments. So it's part of also that tree that one feeds into another. And we see this very much in a recent case that is here illustrated in this photo, four islanders that bring a case against the cement company Holcim in Switzerland. And what happened there is that the Cantonal Court of Zug cites the decision by the European Court of Human Rights in the Klima-Sirinen case for the interpretation of Holcim's obligation and say that it could. So basically, that obligation that was related to states, that was discussed in a regional court of human rights, could be potentially applicable in Swiss private law. Finally, what we see here in the climate washing cases that always respond for the majority of cases against corporations is that we see a high level of success, so around 65% of successful cases, so these we have actually got to that point, but also this last year filings have slowed down. So this is how I end the story of the maturity of the field, and I'll pass it to Kate a bit late. Apologies, Kate. I just checked here. You should have interrupted me, and to continue with the other themes.
Thanks, Joanna, and thanks everybody for being here today. So Joanna's talked a little bit about how cases are starting to mature, but at the same time, we're also seeing new fronts opening up in climate litigation. That's most obvious in the fact that climate cases are arising in new jurisdictions all the time, and just in the last year, the Sabin Center's database has captured cases in Grenada, Guatemala, Kazakhstan, Malaysia, Singapore and Zambia for the first time. But it's not just that courts in these countries are first starting to grapple with challenges around climate change. This is actually part of a global phenomenon and a process of exchange between courts in one country and courts in another. And that's what's illustrated in this beautiful map that you can see here. Which shows some of the major routes of travel between different jurisdictions for decisions. This is just the most visible tip of the iceberg when it comes to this kind of exchange. These are actually cases where one court is citing another court's decision, but we know that there are, underneath all of that, there is exchange between judges, exchange between lawyers, looking outside their national borders to try and understand how they can confront similar issues emerging around the world. We're also seeing climate litigation involving new actors, and one group of actors that we analyzed for the first time is cases that involve state-owned enterprises and financial institutions as the defendants. And we see more than 40 of these cases, many of them filed since 2023, with new cases against Petrobras in Brazil, against KEPCO, a state utility company in South Korea. As we see climate litigation expanding to more emerging economies, we anticipate we may see more of these. And finally, we also see new frontiers opening up in terms of the kind of topics and subject matter that is making its way before courts. So this year, we talk a little bit about three areas to watch: litigation concerning carbon dioxide removal infrastructure, who pays the costs of that infrastructure, for whose benefit. We see cases around data centers, AI, and the environmental footprint of AI, likely to be something we see going forwards. And we also see this kind of convergence where different areas of environmental challenge coming into the cases alongside climate claims. So in plastics, for example, we see cases that are looking along the supply chain and saying, actually, we have the same supply chain that is involved in oil and gas and in plastics and connecting at that kind of systemic level. All of this is happening, as Jonathan has already mentioned, against a coordinated pushback against climate action that we're seeing in some parts of the world. And there's a legal dimension to this pushback or this backlash. We chart three aspects of that legal dimension. The first is what we call anti-climate litigation cases. These are cases that are filed to directly oppose climate policies or increasingly to oppose other kinds of pro-climate litigation. So in the US, for example, there's a case that was filed by Alabama and other states challenging the ability of different states to sue oil and gas companies in the courts for their contributions to climate change and for disinformation. We're also seeing a use of strategic litigation against public participation to try and deter civil society groups from engagement in both climate protest and climate litigation. And a case that many of you will probably have heard of was a case against Greenpeace International for their support for indigenous leaders who convened a protest at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline, resulting in an award for $667 million from a jury in North Dakota. That's since been halved on appeal, but nonetheless has a significant chilling effect. And there's a lot of activity to resist this kind of decision, including an anti-SLAPP case that's been filed in the Netherlands. But nonetheless, this kind of thing does matter for the climate movement. Finally, we're also starting to see the emergence of what we're calling climate liability shield legislation. These are proposals, just proposals at this point, in New Zealand, in the US, and in Germany, that would prevent corporate climate litigation cases from proceeding in the courts at all. Their argument in favor of these is that they will create increased legal certainty. But actually, this kind of intervention in legal systems, before we've even seen decisions from the courts, I think has real brings real questions about uncertainty in the rule of law. And finally, in response to all of this, we're seeing a rise in what we can understand as protective litigation, cases that seek to oppose this kind of regulatory rollback and preserve hard-won legal gains, delaying the dismantling of some aspects of climate infrastructure. This is likely to be one of the most significant phenomena going forwards. We also see a new rise in groups of cases that are not necessarily opposed to climate action per se, but which are seeing courts being brought in as communities are navigating the transition. So we've talked in previous reports about just transition cases where communities and workers are opposing particular types of climate action because of the distributional benefits. Or some of the distributional challenges of that, this year illustrated by a new case about the closure of a coal mine in Australia. We also see these green versus green cases, as we call them, which see questions about biodiversity protection and climate litigation being weighed up against one another, and courts often having to do quite a difficult job of balancing these in the absence of clear legislative guidance on what should be done in these situations. And then in this last year, we've started to see a new kind of complexity emerging in adaptation cases, including cases that are about adaptation and mitigation trade-offs. So the picture at the top of the screen is a new road being built through the Amazon. We see a case against a similar road project. The mitigation case against it is that we know that whenever there's a new road in the forest, it leads to increased deforestation. The claimed adaptation case in favor of it is that as extreme weather events are becoming more severe, usual routes of navigating through the forest using the rivers are more difficult. So we need a way for communities to get around. And these are some of the really difficult challenges that courts are being called to weigh in. And then the final point that I want to make before we pass over to our panel is To just draw your attention to the final part of the report, which asks the real question, does climate litigation drive real world change? In the report, we're very lucky to have this year a guest contributor who did a survey of the field of academic literature. So you can read a very quick synopsis of all of the papers and research projects that are going on this. And we also have a few case studies. We look at what happened in the wake of the Finch and Surrey County Council case, and we're very pleased that Sarah Finch is here, and Ruchi's going to tell us a little bit more about what the UK landscape has looked like following the case. And we also talk a bit about this fascinating case from South Korea, which has had a really interesting political afterlife that has involved a set of questions being put to the legislature about what South Korea's climate ambition should be. The legislature then passed this to the citizenry. They said, we want to know what people think, and they did a set of deliberative polling with a lot of public engagement. And the conclusion of that was that citizens in South Korea want their government to be ambitious. So a really interesting case, only made possible this kind of ongoing impact by ongoing engagement by civil society actors. So that is a whirlwind tour of the report, and we're looking forward to hearing the responses from our panel.
Great.
Thanks very much, Joanna and Kate. Really interesting to hear from both of you about some of the initial quick read through. I think a lot more depth, and maybe we can get to some of it during the Q&A. I want to turn next online to Maria Antonia. Maria, you've got the floor.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much. Congratulations to Ben and Kate on another excellent report. I really am sad to not be there in person, but it's always really exciting to join this launch and really see all of the research that we do behind the scenes in the Saving Center's climate litigation database, and kind of seeing that what Brandon comes up with in terms of what they're observing on trends and so forth. I also need to briefly mention our global peer review network, which is all of the volunteers who are experts on climate change litigation in their own jurisdictions to help us maintain the database. So Kate and Joanna asked me to talk a little bit about remedies. So what claimants are seeking, what courts are ordering, and what we're learning about implementation and enforcement. And I'll make sort of three general observations on that. First, climate litigation has increasingly become a conversation about remedies. For many years, has focused on a couple of threshold questions on non-standing, justice liability, causation, and whether governments or companies owed climate-related obligations at all. And this report shows how much that conversation has changed, right? Courts around the world are increasingly recognizing climate obligations as legal obligations rather than merely political commitments. The three recent advisory opinions that Joanna mentioned from ITLO's, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, and the International Court of Justice are particularly important in that regard, and we're now waiting for another advisory opinion by the African Court as well, which will certainly sort of feed into that. So these advisory opinions help clarify the content of climate obligations and reinforce the legal significance of climate science as well, and providing courts with a stronger framework for understanding state responsibility in the climate context. And that is naturally sort of trickling down into domestic cases as well. At the same time, advances in attribution science and evidentiary methodologies are strengthening the causal foundations of climate claims. Courts are increasingly encountering better developed causal chain links, linking emissions, climate impacts, and harm. And as courts become more comfortable recognizing climate obligations, the central question becomes what should happen after a claimant wins as well, right? So in other words, climate litigation is moving from, recognition of rights and the responsibilities toward remedies and implementation. So my second observation is that remedies themselves are becoming more sophisticated too, and I think that's part of the learning process of over two decades of litigation, right? So traditionally, coming from sort of the environmental litigation kind of feeds into climate litigation, These cases often rely on relatively straightforward remedies, canceling a permit, stopping a project, requiring compliance with existing law, or suspending an approval process. And those remedies remain really important as well, around the world. We continue to see injunctions halting projects, suspending permits, requiring environmental review, often with a climate angle to it as well, or preventing harmful activities from proceeding. And as our work on climate and environmental the remedial orders has shown, we've been doing a lot of work at this at the Sabin Center. Injunctions remain one of the most important tools available to courts because they are inherently forward-looking and can be tailored to prevent future harm. But climate litigation increasingly requires something different, right? Climate change is not a single project, it's a systemic problem. And as a result, courts are increasingly experimenting with structural remedies as well. I've published an article focusing on children's climate litigation and looking at the remedies that have been granted across examples from different regions of the world. And I think one of the most striking findings was really the diversity of remedies that courts have adopted. Successful youth cases have resulted in the cancellation of fossil fuel projects, requirements to revise climate frameworks, emissions reductions commitments, institutional reforms, and mechanisms designed to incorporate the interests of future generations into climate governance as well. So what we're seeing is kind of a gradual evolution from remedies that stop individual harms toward remedies that seek to reshape governance systems as well. And at the same time, another remedial frontier is emerging on damages and compensation, as Joanna mentioned, from those examples in Brazil as well. So the report highlights these growing efforts to develop methodologies capable of quantifying climate-related harms, where judicial standards for calculating climate damages have begun to be adopted and applied as well. And for many years, climate damages, I think, are often viewed as too complex or too speculative, and today, advances in attribution science, environmental evaluation methodologies, and climate accounting are making compensation claims increasingly plausible, right? Just cases from Brazil are an example of that, even though they're enforcement cases, so it's kind of similar to some of the more traditional cases, but adding sort of this climate dynamic into that as well. So whether through adaptation costs or environmental restoration, climate damages, or loss and damage claims, we're likely to see much greater attention to monetary remedies in the coming years as well. And then the third observation that I wanted to make is regards implementation, right? So one of the most important insights from this year's report as well is that climate-aligned judgments do not automatically translate into climate action, right? Implementation requires political will, institutional capacity, and sustained oversight, and this may be really the defining challenge for the next generation of climate litigation. We've just had a decision today on a case that was brought against Total Energies in France, and I think that provides kind of a useful illustration of that too, right? So the claimants in that case asked for really extraordinarily ambitious relief. They sought a revised vigilance plan incorporating climate risk mapping across scope 1, 2, and 3 emissions, alignment with the 1.5 degree pathways, measures addressing hydrocarbon expansion and concrete emissions reductions and investment commitments. And they also requested a financial penalty for non-compliance. The court did not go that far. It ordered Total Energies to supplement its vigilance plan within 6 months by including scope 3 emissions within its risk mapping and related mitigation measures. So that's a significant development, but of a limited intervention based on what they were asking. So the court was willing to require a more complete climate due diligence process. It was willing to require additional disclosure and risk assessment, but it declined to dictate the company's transition strategy or impose a specific emissions reductions pathway. So in other words, I think the court accepted a role in ensuring completeness and compliance, but stopped short of managing corporate climate strategy itself. And I think this captures this broader trend as well that we're seeing globally, with courts increasingly willing to engage with climate governance, but remaining cautious about prescribing the precise policy choices or business decisions that should follow. And I think that's partly because that's the the role that courts should take, right? So they should not be dictating, broader policies, and I think it's sort of appropriate as well. And that brings me to my final point. I think the next frontier in climate litigation is not really whether climate harms are legally cognizable. Courts around the world increasingly accept that they are, but it really, the next frontier is for people, right? So how should courts design remedies that are effective, legitimate, enforceable, and capable of addressing a problem that is global, cumulative, and long-term, right? So that, I think that question will shape the next chapter of climate litigation. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Maria Antonia. Really helpful to have some of those framing remarks that you've offered, particularly on this last point that you've made around remedies, and maybe some of the expectations for the next report that these guys do next year, where we're going to identify all those pieces. So thank you so much. Let me turn next to Ruchi on litigation in the UK.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. So I'm just going to focus hone in on the litigation. Oh, sorry.
Dip it down.
Does this work? Excellent. So I'm going to focus on litigation landscape in the UK, and specifically on the post-Finch landscape, and obviously very pleased that Sarah's here, so I'll try and get everything correct. But in terms of those, I think most of you will be familiar with this case, but essentially it's been exactly 2 years this week, I think, since the landmark judgment that ruled that planning permission for new oil drilling, commercial production of oil in Surrey was deemed unlawful, and it was off the back of the Supreme Court saying for the first time that for the purposes of environmental impact assessments and the EIA regime that we have, downstream emissions are indeed effects of the project and therefore have to be assessed. So it's interesting to see how things have kind of mapped out over the last 2 years. And I think in terms of sort of immediate implications, we almost had like a domino effect on other fossil fuel consents. And so I think basically in the next 6 months or so after the judgment came out, we had the quashing of consents for Lincolnshire, new oil drilling in Lincolnshire, the Cumbria coal mine project, and then also the offshore fields, Rosebank and Jackdaw. And so that was all extremely positive. We also had some new policy from DESNZ, which was to do with assessing scope 3 emissions specifically for offshore oil and gas. And I have to say that was quite groundbreaking for what it was. I mean, the policy definitely went further than any court had done in the UK, and, had been, in my view, quite strong, really, from a climate perspective. So that was all very promising. I think taking a step back and looking at it kind of 2 years in, there's probably two trends that I've certainly identified in practice. The first is legal arguments seeking to constrain the Finch precedent. This has arisen in a few cases. So certainly, it arose very early on in the Cumbria coal mine case, where the developer said, yes, of course, Finch applies, we have to accept that, but we can kind of sidestep it in this case because of substitution-based arguments. We'll be substituting for American dirty coal, etc. And the High Court said, no, that's not right. But I think in the last year, at least, we have seen other arguments come forward seeking to constrain the effects of Finch, really. And this has arisen largely in two cases dealing with airport expansions. It's the Gatwick and Luton challenges. I think Gatwick is actually handed down yesterday. So the interesting argument there is that the developers actually accept that Finch applies. And so traditionally what would happen is you would only quantify the emissions of outbound flights, but accepting that, you have to look at the kind of all scope emissions, you also now have to quantify inbound flight emissions. And so the developers did that. But what the developers did and what the government accepted is that in these cases, they said it's not possible to meaningfully assess the significance of these emissions because they lie outside the UK carbon budget. And in those cases, you don't have to do anything more with it, effectively. So that approach was challenged both in the Luton and Gatwick cases. I said the High Court has accepted what the government has said and has said that is consistent with Finch, namely that if there's no kind of sensible way to assess significance, then you don't need to. I think that poses potentially quite a difficult problem as to what the practical effects of Finch would be. And certainly I think from the perspective of maybe kind of civil society and people working in this field, I think probably the next thing we need to think about, or you need to think about, is, you know, what are those other benchmarks that you can use? Because obviously Scope 3 emissions are always going to be outside of the domestic carbon budgets. So, you know, are there other sectoral budgets that you can draw on? Are there IPCC pathways that you can look at? So I think there probably needs to be some kind of joined up thinking along those lines. So I knew that Grantham's doing that already, which is great. So that's maybe the more restrictive side of things. The second trend is the proliferation of the Finch argument across other sectors that aren't fossil fuel based or, you know, coal mine based. And so that we've seen that Finch principle be deployed in lots of other kind of polluting sectors, and it has been accepted to apply, which is a positive. So it's been used in challenges to data centers. The first legal challenge to a data center in the UK, it was actually conceded by the government, was unlawful, not actually on the Finch ground, but on climate considerations more generally. And then, really interestingly, it's been applied quite successfully in the context of intensive factory farming cases. I think what's been really interesting here is that a few of these cases have gone to court, but actually a lot of these cases have been won without going to court, in that civil society and campaigning groups have used the Finch precedent before local planning authorities and councils to really shift the onus on developers, and essentially have kind of like won the debate without needing to go to court because the planning permission's never been granted. And I think that really probably is kind of the big takeaway with the Finch case and other strategic litigation more generally, is that if you have a really good precedent, actually it does then mean that you can, others can rely on it without necessarily having to go through the court process themselves.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, so that takes me to the second and final theme that I just want to touch on, which is the issue of access to environmental justice. And just by way of background, the reason I think we've been able to have this proliferation of climate-based challenges in the UK has largely been because of the cost protection that is provided under the Aarhus Convention. I think all of you will be familiar, but the Aarhus Convention is based on three pillars, one of which is access to environmental justice, and it requires that this access should not be prohibitively expensive. Now, the reason I've got my laptop with me is because there's one provision that I can never remember exactly what it says, but it's the key one. I obviously know it when I have to do my job, but I need the quote in front of me. Right, so it basically covers acts and omissions by private persons and public authorities which contravene provisions of its national law relating to the environment. I'll come back to this. So, in general, what we have is, in the civil procedure rules, we've got cost capping regime under the Aarhus Convention. That's been obviously super useful. It means that when individuals, local residents, NGOs, etc., want to challenge, they have that, like, you know, their cost risks is limited from the very outset, and so they feel more confident being able to challenge decisions in the event that they're ultimately unsuccessful. And in the types of cases that I've just been talking about, which is individual planning permissions off the back of EIA-based arguments, it's been really well settled that the Aarhus Convention obviously applies. The reason I raise it now is because there is a real question mark about how broadly it applies. And the issue arose in a case brought by Foodrise, formerly Global Feedback, and they sought to challenge regulations giving effect to a free trade agreement with Australia on the basis of kind of increased greenhouse gas emissions from beef imports and carbon leakage arguments. And this was challenged on the procedural basis that this was not an Aarhus Convention claim. It went to the Court of Appeal last year, and the Court of Appeal agreed that it was not protected by the Aarhus Convention. And the court said two things. One is the claimants, in every case, need to identify the precise provision of national law which itself relates to the environment. So it's not good enough to just come along and say, well, our case is obviously about the environment because we're raising greenhouse gas emission arguments. Like, that's not good enough. You have to identify the national provision. And then the second thing, which is quite radical maybe, or not, I don't know, up to others to decide, is that judicial review and public law principles do not form part of the UK law relating to the environment. And this is significant, given that judicial review is the primary legal tool that that people, you know, that individuals and groups can use and civil society can use to hold government to account. So it's a pretty big deal. The I think recognizing that the Supreme Court did grant permission to hear the appeal, that appeal was heard last week or 2 weeks ago, so it's definitely one to watch. And then just maybe again to say something a little bit positive is that apart from the Aarhus Convention, in the UK we've always had a separate cost-capping regime in relation to public interest litigation that was developed in the common law. It's now codified. There's a few more hurdles that you have to meet to kind of qualify. But I think regardless of what happens with the Supreme Court case, I think what we probably will see is that civil society and groups who want to challenge cases, decisions, will always find ways to adapt and be innovative with kind of the legal tools that already exist. And sometimes that's obvious things like the Aarhus Convention, but actually other times it is actually just like common law principles that have already always existed in this country. Cool. That's all for me.
Thanks very much, Ruchi. I think we've got a kind of an interesting case. It would be curious maybe next time if we can do one of these on all these major countries. I'd be curious to see what kind of things emerge with that nuance that you were able to bring. The individual cases clearly matter, and how they apply over time is obviously what we can really learn a lot from. So thank you so much for that. Let me turn next to Michael. Please, you've got the floor.
Sure. Well, thank you all very much, and thanks to Joanna and Kate for a wonderful report. And in case you want to look at the long report, I will say that the illustrations in this report are really top-notch, and it's good. It's just good looking at. Even reading is good too. But I'm actually going to build a little bit on what Ruchi was talking about here. In that, for me as a political scientist, one of the key messages that I think really comes through in this report is that climate lawsuits often matter most outside of the courtroom. Okay. Obviously, it matters what the judge says, it matters whether you win, precedent, etc. But I'll tell two quick stories that sort of illustrate how these cases really can have a real-world difference that isn't even necessarily going to show up in this report, because they're not ultimately directly the consequence of climate litigation, they're indirect effects. So one is around this idea of green versus green cases, right? Where you have climate groups or wind developers, they're pushing forward and they're coming up against other people who are often in good faith truly concerned about other ecological values that are being threatened by these kinds of projects, whether that's conservation or other kinds of sustainability, right? Climate change is not the only sustainability problem that we're facing. And these are often local groups that are genuine, but fossil fuel interests are looking around. And they instrumentalize the opposition from these local green groups, often by providing advice, assistance, legal support to these organizations, and operating more in a logic of the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Some of these local green groups end up accepting assistance from fossil fuel interests. The story that I would tell here is around offshore wind in the northeast of the United States, where there's quite a lot of wind development that is of concern to fishing communities in the local area. There was a particular nonprofit called Green Oceans that was seeking to reverse some permits that had been issued for offshore wind near Rhode Island. And this group, which is not funded by fossil fuels, would often cite in their materials that they would distribute claims made by fossil fuel front groups, right? The Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow. Why do you laugh? Oh, yes. Well, it is funded by Exxon and Peabody and the Koch brothers. So, yes, you can tell from the name sometimes. Now, some researchers at Brown University, they published a peer-reviewed analysis showing the similarities in the kinds of arguments that this local group was making with the fossil fuel interests. the local group then received legal representation from a law firm that's tied to climate skeptic groups, right? And that law firm sent a legal sort of letter to Brown University saying you have to retract these peer-reviewed findings, and if you don't, we're going to go ask the Trump administration to pull all the federal funding that Brown University receives. Now, as it happens, they didn't have to follow through on this threat because a few days later, the Trump administration issued a stop work order on the nearly completed offshore wind project, so they didn't have to ask. The wind project just stopped going forward anyway. But this story around green-on-green concerns, you know, there's environmental justice concerns here because those who are often the wealthiest or the most powerful or can tap in to those networks will often be able to resist renewable energy projects most effectively. Another, you know, the Kennedys, for example, in the United States have been quite vociferous in opposing offshore wind. In my own work, I've found that there's often local opposition when wind developers enter new areas, right? So in combination of the fact that the wealthy and powerful tend to win these green versus green cases, and that new areas are often where we see most opposition sort of get started. Well, if you're a wind developer, you focus on the places where you've already been building and you intensify rather than expand, right? You intensify your development. And what that does is that puts all of our eggs in one basket, right? And if that local community that has a lot of intense wind development decides to revolt, that becomes trouble, right? The second story I'd tell here is that the prospect of climate litigation can also really meaningfully spur improvements in environmental performance. We do see a positive side of this threat of litigation. A few weeks ago, I spoke with the CEO of the Lower Thames Crossing, Matt Palmer. The Lower Thames Crossing is the second largest infrastructure project in the United Kingdom. It's a tunnel underneath the Thames to the east of London. And I was speaking to him because it's the first project, infrastructure project in the UK to go net zero, okay? Second largest infrastructure project and it's net zero. They're cutting their emissions directly by 70% and then offsetting with the remaining 30. And why did they go net zero? I wanted to know, why did you decide to do this? And his answer was, one of the key rationales was, he used to be the CEO of the Heathrow airport expansion. And he has learned a little bit, well, he's learned a thing or two, right? And he was looking around and he said, what can I do for this project to make sure we don't get tied up in court? And the answer is, going net zero has been a really effective defense for this project. It's the only large infrastructure project in the UK that has not been sued on climate grounds, right? Another thing I wanted to know from him is how much does it cost to go net zero? This is a very expensive project, right? It's about 10 billion pounds. How much extra does it cost to go net zero? His answer was between 0 and 2%, maximum 2% extra cost for going net zero. So look, the Lower Thames Crossing, that's a complicated project, all right? But whatever problems it may have, it's not net zero. And climate litigation provided a really big push for them changing how they approach that project. So I'll leave it there.
So thanks very much, Michael. And I think we've got a set of really interesting ways to think about the litigation arena broadly, from the overview that was provided in the report, some quite specific examples, and some of the questions around remedies that Maria Antonia offered to us, and then some detailed studies that I think both Ruchi has provided and Michael's provided. We'll have some chances for questions. I'm gonna go first to the people, write your name down if you're online and would like to ask a question. Please send them in, put your name down, and we can call on you in just a moment. We'll come to the room as well. We've got some microphones on the side and I'll recognize some people. While you're thinking about the question, I'll just put one to the panel while you collect your own thoughts. I'm interested a little bit from all of you, including Maria Antonia, if you're able to be online with us, maybe we could put her back on the screen. I'm interested from all of you about whether you think the judges in these cases are learning things. Do we have enough training for the judges? Are they falling short? We've got all of these new cases. The framing that we're kind of looking at is more complicated. We've got now more case law that they have to all be considering and consulting. A little bit, Marie Antonia, for you on the remedies, but for all of you, is there information that you can glean from the report already or from the examples that you provided? And I open it up to any of you that might choose to answer that.
Well, perhaps it's maybe Joanna and I can start with an answer, and then Maria Antonia will come to you. We've actually just been working on a report for the Council of Europe looking at how judges across Council of Europe member states are implementing environmental protections that exist in the law, and the Council of Europe consultative judicial body was surveying its members to understand whether they felt they needed additional training, whether there was a sense that specialization of courts would be useful, a series of these kinds of different questions. And kind of sneak peek of some of the findings that actually several of the judges did say environmental cases of all kinds, not just climate litigation, do raise challenging questions, not questions courts can't deal with, but questions that they are aided in dealing with if they have access to really good expert evidence. There are a number of different mechanisms across courts within Council of Europe member states to allow for the appointment of lay people, non-judges, with some kind of scientific expertise in cases and so on. So there are solutions available. And I think judges, across the board in their work are confronted with really complicated issues. You know, think about financial crime. That's hard stuff to follow. And our judiciaries are capable of responding, particularly if given the resources that they're asking for and the resources that they need. So that would be my first thought. But
it's our joint answer.
A joint answer. I love these. Maria Antonia, anything you wanted to add?
I think the way that they're doing that most of the time is also looking at what courts in other jurisdictions are doing. So we're seeing a lot of that cross-jurisdictional conversation, which is really interesting as well.
One of the things I just would note, I was recently told about an effort being mounted in the United States to block an NGO that has been seeking to train judges. And so the whole thing is kind of wrapped up in a much more complicated, the slap suits are part of it, is a much more complicated story, and I think the pushback that you all talked about in the report is real. I don't know if there's anything in the UK case or the political science side that you'd like to bring to the
table. I would just add that the Environmental Law Institute, an NGO in the US working internationally, about 20 years ago, they ran a survey in Haiti. So this is out of date, okay? But you don't get to run a survey of judges every day. And they ran a survey of judges in Haiti, and they found that 95% of the judges in their survey were unfamiliar with Haiti's own environmental laws. It just wasn't part of the judicial training in the 90s and early 2000s. Whether that's changed, you might wonder, but certainly there's plenty of room for education to be had.
So thanks very much. I don't want to go back now to everyone else. This is a large and clearly engaged community. Raise your hand. We'll bring the microphone around. Way in the back corner, please. You've got the floor, and wait for the microphone. Please introduce yourself and keep your questions short. We'll have quite a number of questions, I'm sure.
Right, I'll stand up so you can see me. My name is Howard Misigwa, and I'm a master's student at the University of Edinburgh on the Environmental and Climate Change Law Program, but I come from Uganda. And so my question is, again, to do partly with that slap suits we've seen against climate litigation, but also with the ecosystem, because where I come from in Uganda, it's an offense, actually, for you, for example, to bring a case against the big pipeline we have in Uganda, the East African crude oil pipeline. So from the panelists, what are some of those strategies that, you know, emerging advocates like myself who want to make a contribution can make when the ecosystem is not conducive and sometimes a threat to your own life? Thank you.
Great, we'll hold that one and we'll take a couple more. Anybody? Yes, please, right here in the blue shirt in the middle. And please introduce yourself as well.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the great panel. I'm Marcelo Lozada, I work for the Net Zero Lawyers Alliance. I wanted to ask you about the pushback and complexity themes that you mentioned, and I wonder what your views are about what that means in terms of the intrinsic limitations to some extent of climate litigation in achieving certain providing certain responses for wider societal issues, and whether that tells us something about the need of complementary legislative schemes that respond to some of these issues. I'm thinking about corporate accountability and some of the legislative schemes that are being researched on. So how do you feel about these pushbacks and complexity? Because I think some of that, it reflects just the inherent difficulties that judges are confronted with, we're having to provide an answer for which there is not necessarily a right answer, which they're not comfortable with. Thank you.
Great. We'll take a third question online, and we can read it out.
Great. Someone has asked, are there already examples of the operationalization of the ICJ's advisory opinion in domestic litigation? Does the panel see there being some arguments that are ripe for integrating?
Great. So we'll start with those three questions. We'll do some more rounds. We've got a little bit of time. And maybe I'll turn it back to the panel. Please help yourselves. Three really interesting questions with a number of possible ways to address them. Joanna, do you want to start?
Sure. Thank you for the questions. I think I will start with the hardest one, which I don't know the answer, of our friend from Uganda that asks how to bring a case when the system is not conducive to that. I think it's true, it is true that we've seen the largest number of cases so far in countries that are conductive. So if you see the growth of cases in Brazil, there used to be none until a few years ago, and then suddenly you have 400, and one of the reasons is that the system allows that you have options not only for the prosecutors, as I mentioned, but also for class actions, and that the access to justice, that these are not prohibitive, that you can not only have the right to access the court, but also that it won't cost more than an NGO can pay, and also even if they lose, it's still something plausible. There's a reversal of the burden of proof. So there are many mechanisms that clearly allow for that to happen. So I started with the opposite. And then you see how when those mechanisms don't exist, and also adding to that, having the laws, if you don't have a law to hold on to, if you don't have the right to a healthy environment in your constitution, that's going to also make it harder. So we see very clearly what are the several legal and also financial reasons why some countries will see more. Now, when none of those are present, it is a challenge, but also it is not impossible. And I think this is where we've seen also even in such countries efforts to with a project, with linking to air pollution, with linking to other issues. I think air pollution is a good example of when climate is not welcome in the court, or is the court is not familiar, that we've seen that happen. But I guess there will be a real discrepancy there, depending on how much is there to bring a case. And then maybe already answering to Marcel, and I'll pass it on, the important part of this whole story is legislation, is whether your national government or sometimes subnational governments have set something in law that will allow the enforcement. It will allow, if that's not being implemented, lawsuits to enforce. It will allow so much more than if that legislation is not present. So ultimately, what we would like to see is more legislation and less litigation. And at the same time, once you have that legislation, you can allow for that to be brought into force. If anyone wants to speak, the other ones.
I turn to Maria Antonia and ask you as well on the remedies side, which you've been speaking to. Are you able to think a little bit, is there information that you've got about some of these circumstances where the rule of law is weaker? Are there distinctions that we can draw? Are there solutions that you're seeing that people are seeking workarounds on?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think, there are a lot of cases that relate to enforcement of existing laws, and that relates to the rule of law piece of it as well. They're just requesting the courts to either sort of work on request the government to regulate an activity of something that was predicted in the law and was never fully done, or really to draft legislation and all of that. How Joanna was mentioning as well. But I think sort of when the rule of law itself is weak, you know, like I guess the courts aren't really available to provide the remedies that they're looking for. We've been seeing sort of UN complaints as well. There was just one filed this week against Australia. So that's not really a rule of law issue, but it's kind of a workaround to whenever the court itself cannot provide a feasible solution, right? I'm trying to think if there are other examples that I can think of where this has happened, but I can't remember from the top of my head if there are any other ones like that.
I think it's going to start playing out in ways as people push back. So it's maybe an interesting area to explore. Michael, I wonder if you want to take the question, or Ruchi maybe take the question with the societal pushback. Finch may be partly responsive, but then you have the other response from your example of the Thames bypass.
Shall I say something just very quick? I was going to say something about legislation first.
Please.
And then I'll come back to your question. So yes, I think it cannot overstate more how litigation is just one tool in the many tools that civil society have, and I don't think you can kind of elevate it beyond the role that it plays. And I think actually in just the examples that I was giving post Finch, like you can see that play out where you had a really really strong political will on what it means to assess significance of scope 3 emissions, which came in the form of DESNZ guidance, which was extremely clear and said, well, these are the ways in which you assess significance. You have to look at cumulative effects. You have to look at IPCC pathways, like very sophisticated reasoning. And then the same arguments when they were put forward in a different context before the courts said, actually, we're not going to engage any further for various reasons. So I think actually, if you don't have the political will and the legislation to kind of balance it all out, I'm not sure whether we'd necessarily achieve much. And in terms of maybe societal pushback, I mean, it's interesting you look actually Michael's examples as well, because this week I am in hearings which are looking at just obviously forgotten immediately what I've done all week, looking at the new national infrastructure overhead pylons from Norfolk to Tilbury. It's 180-kilometer scheme of new electricity overhead lines and new substation, etc. And the biggest concern is local residents, and actually that is a part of the country that has had a lot of infrastructure. It's had all the offshore wind in East in that kind of Suffolk coast. It's had Sizewell C, and people are fed up. And they're not coming there to be disruptors, I don't think. They're coming there with genuine concerns about the quality of their lives. And I think suddenly, the way these hearings have played out and others that I've seen, I do think that, having these, we have essentially 6-month-long examinations that assess whether national infrastructure projects should go ahead or not, and they're very detailed, and they're part written, part oral. Anyway, the inspectors take a huge amount of time, and I think that's really, really important, because I think local residents need to feel like they're part of the solution and not that this is being dumped on them.
Michael? I'll answer also to, it was Howard, I think. Howard's question around, I think treating climate litigation as not just one tool among many, but as a political tool, right? And that sometimes success is not from winning in the courtroom, where maybe in some cases you don't have much of a chance of winning in the courtroom, but it's from raising the drama, from getting attention, and then being able to use that drama to put new pressure, to gain allies that are in a better position to pressure those with power. So this is that dynamic that actually Maria Antonia mentioned going to the international level. There's an idea of the boomerang, right? You throw it out to the international level, and it comes back putting pressure on those in power in a new way. And so raising the cost of injustice for those who are in power by putting the people who they actually do rely on for their authority, for their resources, making them angry, well then all of a sudden you have some room to go. So maybe you don't win in court. You don't win in court, but you get new dynamics are created. On societal pushback, there are a couple of dynamics that are going on, right? The first is, I think a lot of you might have been surprised to hear that lower Thames Crossing, it's maximum 2% extra to go net zero, right? Even in a pretty informed room, there's a lot of misunderstanding about exactly how much it costs to go green. It actually often costs less than one might think, right? However, it's not about the cost of going green. That's a little bit of a red herring. It's the losses from, it's the opportunity cost, right? It's the losses from stranded assets that now you've invested in and you're not going to get the full economic value from because you're going to have to retire it early. Or it's from the other uses of that land, of that space that people were making money from, that people were enjoying. If you buy a house by the sea because you want to have a moment of tranquility, you really very genuinely have grounds to think, boy, I really wish I didn't buy that house if they're going to be building a wind turbine right next to it. And so finding ways to have those societal discussions, engaging with communities to talk about where to find compromise, where to find places where money can make it better. Sometimes money doesn't make it better. Other times money makes it better. And finding those opportunities where we have tools for compensation, where we have tools for recognition, and finding ways to build political agreement from that.
Thanks. Would one of you guys like to answer the ICJ question?
Sure, I'm happy to. And then I think this is probably something that Maria Antonia would also have views on, because I know she's done a huge amount of work on these cases. But the simple answer is yes, we are seeing the ICJ opinion, also the opinion from the International Tribunal of the Law of the Sea, and the Inter-American Court of Human Rights appearing in domestic cases, even in some kinds of cases that you might be quite surprised by. So, of course, we've seen these opinions referenced in cases about state obligations. That's fundamentally what they concern. We've also seen them being raised in cases about greenwashing, climate washing, in cases in Brazil, in the new case that's just been filed for the first time in Malaysia. So they are kind of trickling down into the domestic sphere in ways that I think we'll need to be tracking for quite some time to see kind of all of the different ways in which they turn up. But I think those are hugely important and persuasive for litigants to use in their arguments. And Maria Antonia, I don't know if you want to comment on that.
You know, it's still a year, we're almost at the anniversary of the ICJ's advisory opinion, right? And we've reached that for ITWLS and the Inter-American Court already. But I think we're just seeing the beginning of that trickling down effect. One of the interesting things that I would flag is the Bonaire decision from earlier this year, which not only cited the ICJ's advisory opinion, but also the Inter-American Court, which doesn't, you know, wouldn't necessarily have a direct effect on a, you know, a court in the Netherlands. So I think that sort of convergence as well is really interesting to see coming out of all of this. But and we'll see what's going to happen with the African Court as well, because I think that's going to have some big effects too.
Great. I think we maybe have time for one more round. Would that be okay? Very short. Very short. All right. We'll do one online. We have one online, and we'll take two more from the audience. We'll do one online first.
This question comes from Ferdinand, a doctoral candidate in international law at the Catholic University of Central Africa in Cameroon. They ask, do you think these advisory opinions effectively contribute to the implementation of the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities according to the specificities of some regions of the world? For example, Africa is the least responsible but most vulnerable continent to climate change. How do these advisory opinions contribute to the effective implementation of the CBDR principle in Africa?
Thanks very much. And we got a couple of hands here. Let's go back here in the middle with glasses. Yep. Gentleman here in the polo shirt.
Hi, I'm Abdullah. I'm year 12 at the LA. And I just wanted to ask, last night the President of the United States said that the UK is dying regarding North Sea oil and not actually drilling in it. So we talked about earlier how there were 42 cases against state-owned and financial enterprise institutions. So if the UK did start drilling in the North Sea, could we potentially become the 43rd case?
Right. And we'll get one more way in the back. The microphone back there, that'd be great.
Thank you so much. I'm Nishtha.
Hold it close.
Sorry.
There you go.
Am I audible?
I think
it's almost
that's
like Dean's right at the back here. But I'm Nishtha, I'm with the Oxford Sustainable Law Program. And I was just curious about your view on the post-Lalouia transnational climate litigation. And I'm thinking about enforcement, like cross-jurisdictional enforcement issues, if this is something that picks up. Because I'm an India-trained lawyer and I'm drawing parallels between how things worked out post the Bhopal gas tragedy, that we had a lot of damages that were awarded, but in the implementation is where it became a problem. And so in that context, I'm thinking about remedies and enforcement, and where do you see that going? Thank you so much.
So great, thanks very much. We'll do some short answers and then we'll wrap up, but let me turn the floor perhaps to Kate and Joanna.
Sure. So the question about how the advisory opinions might help to implement the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, I think that's a really good question. And of course, these opinions reaffirm that principle. And there's some really interesting points that are made about the obligations of countries with historically high emissions as well as currently high emissions in the decisions. I think what we're really going to see, though, is the real impact of these cases is going to be what is done with them at the domestic level. So how are litigants relying on these kinds of arguments in the cases that they're bringing? And also whether or not these opinions start to inform the way in which legislators are starting to think about climate change and climate issues and how they're interpreting their obligations at the level of different national parliaments. So, I think, we've got a lot more to see there. And then just to pick up that question about the cross-jurisdictional enforcement, certainly one of the things that we see at the moment is more of these cross-jurisdictional cases being allowed to go to trial. No successes yet, but we may start to see them, and we comment on that in the report, as well as a new generation of cases that's being filed, learning from some of the partial successes, like the Liu case, which confirmed that you could bring this kind of case on the law, but failed on the facts. And I think it's a long way until we get to the actual questions about enforcement of the judgments, but certainly there are going to be questions and challenges. And I think it's no coincidence that a lot of the cases have started in Europe, where some of those issues are governed by quite clear European law. But I think absolutely that's going to be kind of one of the challenges of this new phase of enforcement.
Anyone want to take the question about the UK and the US? Please, help yourselves.
Do you want to go first or no?
I suppose the short answer is that if the UK were to start expanding its North Sea drilling, I'm not sure, there would certainly be climate litigation, one might expect. I don't know how that would work out. But, Just Stop Oil is not around anymore. The reason why they disbanded, they say, is because they won. That they managed to get the UK government to commit to stop expanding oil drilling in the North Sea. So if there was to be walking back on that promise, that would be another avenue in which pressure might come up.
Yeah, and just to add to that, as I was saying, there will obviously be like the climate litigation angle, but also to reinforce that some of these battles can be won like on wider grounds, so cost of living crisis, etc. And actually that is another reason why, it absolutely makes no sense for lots of reasons. I actually can't stop talking about it because I feel like we'll run out of time. So I'll say something very quickly about the CBDR principle though, because there was a case maybe 4 years ago, it was the last big offshore licensing round that led to 100 new licenses, whenever it was, 2023. And that was challenged, one of the grounds of challenge was about CBDR and not taking that into account. And that ground did not get permission to proceed. The other grounds did, to a final hearing. But I think now that we have a little bit more guidance, specifically from the ICJ in terms of that being part of customary international law, we know that customary international law is a source of common law, can at least could be a source of common law. It's all very complicated legal arguments, but I think there's probably, we're going to see cases trying to re-argue that point.
Thanks. Maria Antonia, anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, maybe on the CBDR as well. I think one of the really interesting things that the ICJ has said was that CBDR is also not static, right? So I think a lot of Global South countries keep using that argument of like, you know, I'm a developing country, so I don't have any obligations, like in Brazil included, and I can speak about Brazil because I'm from Brazil, so that's the one that I feel really confident to speak about. But obviously Brazil's emissions now are very high, and most of them are due to deforestation, so they're, you know, they're, it's really an enforcement of existing policies. So I think that part was really interesting, because they didn't say, you know, if you're a developing country, you don't have any obligations to mitigate. It was exactly the opposite. And I think that will have significant consequences for the African continent as well, and we'll likely see more of that in the African Courts Advisory Committee too.
So thanks very much. I think I'd only add one thing. I spent maybe 30 years of my life negotiating those climate agreements. And CBDR has been one of the most contentious things we've done. Of course, we've now added another clause to it, and respective capabilities has now been added to that CBDR component. And that's shifting as well, very much as Maria Antonia has indicated. So I think it's fluid. And I think it'll be partly a function of definitional questions, which the negotiators will in fact pick up and could lead to modifications as the courts themselves grapple with how it's interpreted. And in some ways, that might be a fitting way to end, because I think it gives us a sense, not only the complexity, but the kind of dynamism in this arena. The number of new cases, the conversations that we're all having here, the discussions that the judges are having, the conversations that all of our litigants are having. I think we're seeing an incredible profusion as these ideas are being tested in each of our countries. And I think this kind of a conversation, drawing on the kind of depth of information that this report includes, as well as the expert opinions and advice in the panel, I think gives us new insights. So let me have us all join in thanking the panel. Thank you all for joining us, and we look forward to the discussion.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.